Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, Holly.
Hey, Dave.
Or should I go? Give you the...
Well, in order for our audience to know what you're doing, you have to give them a little hint.
Give them a verbal hint. Two slaps on the knee and then a point. Actually, I think that's what you do when you leave, right? Was that her hello or her goodbye salute? We're talking about Susie Quattro, who was on Happy Days. She gave two slaps and then a point at that person. Like, hey, I see you.
She was Leather Tescadero, and I think it was just a general greeting like aloha, but probably there are people who can correct us on that.
Like aloha?
Or shalom.
Okay. It can mean hello or goodbye. Okay.
Right.
Okay, I gotcha. All right. Well, we were introduced to Susie Quattro through Leather Tescadero. Of course, we learn a few years later, like, oh, Susie's got quite a catalog of music, and she rocks, and she's super cool, and now we got the opportunity to talk with her.
Not just that she rocked, but she was a trailblazer. I mean, she was a phenomenal singing bass player.
She's re-releasing her 80s collection, Rock Hard, Main Attraction, and Unreleased Emotion.
By the way, that collection of albums that she's re-releasing is called The Rock Box.
50 years plus, Susie's still on the road and kicking it. She looks great, and she's got some great stories. She's got this Susie Q documentary that Holly and I just watched, and we're still buzzing from that. And so we have questions, and Susie has answers. Before we do, please, Holly, while we have your attention and we tease you out, this is our teaser. Go ahead. Where can they find us?
Please check out our YouTube channel. You will find outtakes from this interview and many others. Go to our YouTube channel at What Difference Does It Make Podcast. And also you will find some clips on our social media, WDDIM Podcast.
Love that. New episodes every Friday. So subscribe. We're going into our virtual What Difference Does It Make studios and talk with Susie Quattro. Susie Q. Oh, look at that. She's got the wall.
It's the bragging. It's the bragging wall. It's actually around the whole room. It's the drowning. And let me just turn on the light here for you. Got a nice light shot.
I feel like I want to screenshot that and use it as my own.
You're right.
They make good decoration in the dining room.
Yes.
They just look good.
Yeah.
Or we can just earn some. Home is in England?
Yeah, I've been in England since 71, and I've lived in Essex since 75 in the countryside. I'm between Chelmsford and Braintree. I live in the middle of the countryside in a 15th century Elizabethan manor house.
We don't have any of those here in Los Angeles.
No. This house was finished being built in 1590. Yeah, for a girl from Detroit, you just can't compute it.
Yeah.
And so what we're looking at is just a small fraction of the 50 years that you've been in business. This is just like a...
I've been 58 years.
My apologies.
I think you're talking about the first album, right? We're coming up on...
Well, I mean, I've been in the business for 58 years because I started at 14 in my first band. So, and we went immediately on the road, did gigs and all that. So it's been a long time.
You are about to play Royal Albert Hall?
We play there on Wednesday. And I'm like, I've been practicing this. I've got my intro all worked out. Ready?
Oh, yes.
Yes, please.
The Queen of Rock and Roll is playing the Royal Albert Hall. And this is going to become this.
Oh, nice.
I hope that's not blasphemous, but I don't care. Yeah. She's not my queen. She's not my queen, but she does a good job.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, I'm looking forward to it, obviously.
I think your audience will appreciate that. I don't think they're going to have no issue with that.
I wasn't sure because you're in England, isn't it? It's the middle fingers, the two fingers that you show.
So in England, this is the same as that.
You're right.
You do that.
From what I understand, that's like an archer thing. Like in archery, back in the 1590s when there was archery, like they would show
that they reason.
Like I still have my two fingers. And so that was like as they left.
Yeah. That's like, I remember my dad coming to some shows, and that you just reminded me, random memory. My dad came to some shows in the very early days in the Pleasure Seekers. And I've always had the same attitude. I've always been the devil in me. It's always been the same.
Yeah.
And I used to do, baby, everything is all right, uptight. And I thought that was funny. And my dad said, don't do that. But they do it back.
Oh. Yeah, that's the love. There you go. That's rock and roll love right there.
He came to be okay with it after a while?
No, he just got tired of saying it. You know, I've got that mentality that if you say don't do something,
have you learned?
I'm going to do it double time then.
And you raised a couple kids as well. Did you learn any lessons like that? Like, don't tell them what not to do because they're just going to go on and do that. Don't be in a rock and roll band. Don't produce mom's records.
I didn't do that. I didn't do that at all. I was raised with the freedom of expression artistically. You know, my dad had five kids. We all played. He played. So it was never a case of having to fight my parents to be in a band. They were all for it. So I tried to give both my kids the same freedom that they wanted to pursue that as a job, as a career, completely for it. And I didn't know he was going to turn out like he did my son. God, what a surprise. Really. Yeah. Two albums in now, you know.
Right.
In a good way. A surprise in a good way.
Well, he was always in bands, and I think what he did was he quietly got really good on guitar, and he didn't push himself forward until he did.
Yeah.
This was 2019, and he just said, I need to write with you now. And I went, right? Okay, where did that come from? And long story short, he showed me what he had, and I said, okay, come work with that. Started to write a few songs. Went into the studio to make a demo for three songs, having fun. Third demo went. I turned to the engineer and I turned to my son, Richard, and I said, we're making an album. And they said, we know. And all of a sudden, from having fun, it was serious. And it just flew. We really connected.
Now, does he take the lead now in this? Or is it like, okay, you got to listen to mom? Or how's that dynamic work in the studio?
Well, the first album was Getting Your Feet Wet. And seeing how we worked together, trying different things. I remember saying to my son, and he had to adjust more than I did because I've worked with family before, he hasn't.
Yeah.
So for me, it was just quite natural. And also, I'm not mom when I'm working. Relationship out the window. But I remember saying to him, now that we know we're making an album, this is on No Control. I said, I don't want any barriers. I don't want any tracks to run down. I just want whatever happens to happen. So you've got a very organic album, that first album, you know, bit of him, bit of me, bit of us together, whatever. And that was successful. Very, very good critics. And then when we were going to do the second one, lockdown happened. And I said to him, we're not on the road now because there's no gig. So he was on the road with the band he worked with. I was 85 shows. I said, okay, we got the space. We're going to write. And then he got his confidence up on that first album, big time, of course. Yeah. And then he said to me, all the way right from the beginning, I know what this next album should sound like. The benchmark is the first album you made, Suzy Quatro. And trust me, he must have said it 800 times. Trust me. And I'm, you know, whenever a man says trust me, it doesn't matter if he's right. Listening or not. You have to doubt that. But I have now learned to trust him and let him not dictate, but I let him lead the way, because what he's showed me now is that he's been watching me, Suzy Quatro, I have to say, on stage since as far back as his memory goes. Okay. That's a lot of soaking up DNA. Okay. Mm-hmm. And he sees me in a certain way. He's watched me all those years. So what he's done, he's brought back to the table this rebirth. It's like, I didn't think I needed rebirthing. I've always been the same, always go, go, go. But it's like I was able to see myself fresh is the word I'm looking for. He's made me see myself fresh as if I'm just beginning. And actually, that was his intention. And he managed to do that. So I was as excited. Oh, my God, do I do that? Oh, wow. You know, you're watching the reaction. And yeah, so I trust him now. And we work well together. Sure, a few bits and pieces artistically. But when you're creating something, if you don't have that, something's wrong. Sometimes, you know, one of you hears something strongly, the other one doesn't. You got to fight your corner. You know, I don't ever pull rank because I don't think that's right. I don't think that's right. But I will say it quite strongly if I believe it. So will he, and go back and forth. But it's worked out great because the devil in me had the best critics of my career. Embarrassingly wonderful.
Was there one song in particular like, wow, you are right, this song reminds me of my debut album?
I think The Devil in Me has that. Motor City Riders has that. I Sold My Soul Today. Whoa, that's a killer on stage. That's a killer. It's an arm killer because it's all the way through, and I don't pick, so my arm gets cramped. You know? I wait for those two chords where you stop. You know? You know, it's all good. It's hard to choose a track. And even the critics and all the interviews I've done, nobody can choose a track. Yeah. I love the Christmas one. I love My Heart and Soul, I Need You Over Christmas, because it was, it awakened in me my Motown, you know, that I grew up with.
Watching your documentary and you going to Motown and like, okay, here you're like reliving the moment again. Was that planned out? Like this documentary, the director say, okay, let's go to Motown. Let's do like a tour of your life, or how did that come about?
That wasn't planned. In fact, that bit of footage I believe was shot at my 65th birthday party in Detroit. I had my 60th there and my 65th. Mm-hmm. And both times we went to Motown Studios. I had told the director that story before, you know, when I went down in the pit and played with Jeff Beck and Cozy Pop. Give me a break. Who can say that? and I'll say it again, you know, name drop. Okay. And he wanted me to go in that little pit and repeat the story. So he said, perfect opportunity. Here we are. So, and I went and relived it. Fantastic.
Oh. Well, I've been there. And what's amazing is how you say little. It is little. It's tiny.
Doesn't need to be.
Yeah, everyone was. Did you feel like you were like everyone jammed into one little spot?
No, you know, when you come up where I've come up from, playing on gymnasium floors, playing on a postage stamp size stage, changing in the kitchen. I mean, you reminded me of a funny story. We were on tour in Australia. Must have been the 80s because I had both kids with me. And we were on top at the pool area where Duran Duran, I believe it was Duran Duran, who also had their kids and nanny with them. And we got talking. He said to me, oh, I'm so tired. I said, why? He said, well, we did three gigs in a row. I said, what? And that made you talk. That made me laugh.
The small violins.
Yeah. In my era, you got the training. You did. You got five sets a night, 45 on, 15 off. You learned your craft. You did.
So you really did put in your 10,000 hours.
Oh, yeah.
That was like your Beatles moment. Was the Pleasure Seekers, was that the five gigs a night?
No, it was exactly what it was. Because the scene back then was you had a club circuit, you know. We didn't have any success yet, so. And there weren't festivals as yet, you know. So you did your work where you could find it, either teen clubs or drinking clubs or whatever. And we were an all-girl band, and we got booked in a lot of bar clubs where they like to see all the girls, you know. So, and we did do 45 on, 15 off, five sets a night. Amazing.
Obviously covers and originals, or what did the audience want to hear? And usually you have to fight to play your originals. Was that the situation with you with the Pleasure Seekers?
In the Pleasure Seekers, we were a cover band, really. We did a Motown set, we did a Beatles set, we did top 40 set, you know, we had different things that we did. Then when the Pleasure Seekers changed into Cradle, which is only 18 months of the band, we decided to write our own material. And then we went out like that. We did a few covers, but we did really our own stuff. So we had changed at that point. We brought my little sister in to sing, and I kind of stood back out of being the full front person, you know, 99% of the songs. I went back a little bit and played bass, mainly. Did three or four songs a night. And that's the band that Mickey Mo saw. And that's the band where I stepped up and did two songs out of a whole night. And he said, come here. So it was my time. And I always say, you can't hide the light. You can't hide the light because it shines out no matter what.
All right. Loving this talk with Susie Quatro. But the time has come where we take a break. So we will be right back.
stumbling back into our chat with Susie Quattro on the What Difference Does It Make podcast. The way you tell it, you were just told to play bass, so that's what you did.
Correct. We had seen the Beatles on TV, went running to the phones. Two sisters lived around the corner. My dad's clarinet player, his daughter, she was on the other phone. It's all interrelated. And we just started, and my one sister, Patty, she said, why don't we start an our girl band? Everybody went, yeah. And then it was so funny because I kind of was standing third person hearing all these phone calls. And Nan Ball, she's passed away now, she said, I want to play drums. Lance said, I'm playing keys. Mary Lou said, I'm playing rhythm. Patty said, I'm playing lead. And I went, hello, what am I playing? And my sister Patty said, you're playing bass. I said, okay. I already played percussion and classical piano. And I asked my dad for a bass guitar, and he was a musician, so he had one. Whenever I tell musicians this, I see them turn green. They want to kill me. My dad gave me for my first bass to play. I was 14 years old, a 1957 Fender Precision. It's like giving somebody a Rolls Royce for the first car. So I didn't know that there was a smaller neck, a smaller bass. I didn't question it. Because I learned a heavy, long neck, difficult to play bass, I ended up a great bass player. Yeah. But I didn't know this. It wasn't on purpose, you know. I just said, oh, thanks, Dad. I said, this is what I got to do. But it was a love affair. It was a love affair. As soon as I put that on,
yeah,
that really felt like me.
And you did showcase that in the documentary. Yeah. Like, this is it. This is my...
It's just me.
And that must have been tough. I mean, you're a small girl, and you're, when you're on stage, I guess it came naturally to kind of, you know, enhance the music and move around and dance. But you've got this thing, this beautiful instrument that you have to kind of showcase and, you know, got perform.
A lot of people say that, and I didn't really. It's so funny because apparently, playing bass and lead singing is near impossible.
Yeah.
I play percussion, so I'm already thinking with all the parts, okay?
Yeah.
I play piano. It's a percussive instrument. And I think what worked in my favor, although again, not on purpose, when I was given the bass to learn to play bass in the band, I was also given the job of lead singer. So I learned to play the bass and to sing the lead right at the same time. So for me, they just went together. Yeah. I never thought about it. Yeah. How lucky was I? Wow.
But, how long did it take you to realize that there weren't very many lead singers / bassists out there?
Well, everybody kept saying it to me. And I kept going like, what is your problem? So, well, I sing and play, you know.
I mean, you must have been a Paul McCartney fan. Was he your favorite Beatle?
He's I like Paul very much. He's a nice guy. He's another Gemini like me. He's a good player. He plays. But Paul started on guitars, and we had this conversation. We had dinner one time, and I said to him, I didn't mean to insult him. Actually, I don't think I did insult him, but I said, I'm not a failed guitar player. I'm a bass player. And he went, you know, how to make friends.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
influence.
Yeah.
Oops.
I'm sure he took that well. That's
it flew out before I could stop it. Anyway, you can't take it back. It's already there in the air, you know.
No, that's mass respect in that. He didn't. He's just like, yeah, okay. You know, just kind of playfully played with that. I love that.
Well, just because Kathy Valentine plays bass doesn't mean she's a failed guitar player.
No, we've had this conversation. That's so funny. I did a Zoom when my documentary came out with Kathy and Cherie and me, and they were hosting it, and I was their guest. It was all for Susie Q. We were talking, and all of a sudden, Kathy was crying. And Cherie cried when she gave me my She Walks Award, my Icon Award. I have to tell you the story now that I started. I went to the first premiere of Susie Q in London at the Regent Theatre, and I come up for a Q&A at the end, like you do. And I wanted to see the documentary with an audience because that's how you really gauge it. You get the reaction, you know? So I snuck in. Wasn't supposed to be in there to the end. I snuck in, stood on the side. A couple people saw me and I went, shh, shh. So I'm watching, feeling everybody reacting, you know? And every girl that came on and everybody that you can think of, Debbie, Joan, of course, Kathy, Tina Weymouth, Katie Tunstall, Cherie, I'm sure I'm forgetting some. Anyway, every time somebody came on and they said something about me, I was in tears. I didn't have an agenda. I didn't know that I was doing what I was doing because I was just being me. So I didn't go, oh, I'm going to be a girl and do this. Didn't come in my head. I'm just a bass player. I'm a musician. And I went home. I went up, did the question and answer, went home. Next day I called Cherie, good friend of mine now, Cherie Curry, the ex-lead singer of the Runaways. And I told her this story. And I said, I have to tell you something. I said, I've just realized that by me doing what I did, I gave permission to women all over the world to be different. And there was a long pause. And then she, wonderful, she went, and you just got that?
Yeah.
I did, Justin. But it's nice because you see what I mean when I say I didn't have an agenda. But now that I get it, it humbles me. And I do realize that I did that without meaning to. But if you think about it psychologically, it had to be done that way, that it wasn't done on purpose, or it would have been manufactured. You know what I mean?
Sure.
I look at this in hindsight now. I did not know I was doing what I was doing. I was just being me. And I'm still like that now. I will not change who I am, my voice, my attitude, whatever. Even if I don't make it, I'm going to stay this person. That's kind of my mantra. I've gotten all serious on you now. Sorry about that.
No, that's all right. So yeah, you didn't realize there were barriers. I don't know if naive is the right word, but you're just like, I didn't realize that I couldn't do this, right? So you just... Yeah. Did what needed to be done? Like, okay.
The first time, and my husband pointed it out to me because I've told this story many times. I was 5 and a half and I was watching the Ed Sullivan Show with all 5 kids and my mom and dad. You know, everything stopped at 8 o'clock Sunday, yeah. Ed Sullivan. And 5 and a half years old only. And at the end of the show, he brings out something for the youngsters, like he said, something for the youngsters. And he brings out Elvis Presley doing Don't Be Cruel. My elder sister, about 9 years, starts screaming. I'm only 5 and a half and I'm looking at her going, what's the matter with you? And then I looked at the TV and I went in. And I swear to God, like a little light bulb, I'm going to do that. And in answer to your question, it didn't occur to me that he was a guy and I was a girl. That never went in my head. Just, I'm going to do that. So I guess I'm kind of, I don't really do gender as such, although I do in some ways. I have a barrier. You know, and I can be one of the guys and tell the dirty joke with you and blah, blah. But you go over that line and then my feminine barrier comes in and you only cross the line one time.
And you guys had all, you and your sisters had all been encouraged by your dad since he was a musician?
100%. He had 4 daughters, 1 son. My brother was a teenage star on the Lawrence Welk Show in the little band on TV for about a year. My dad was 100% for it. He was helped us get our van, helped us buy our equipment. He turned the garage into a rehearsal space. So we didn't have that problem of fighting with our parents to be in a rock and roll band. Isn't that wonderful? And I'll tell you a little story though, that something my dad said to me and stayed with me my whole life. Like I said, 58 years in the business. I take it serious, what I do, very serious. I was about 16, so I've been in the band 2 years, you know, with my sisters. And he pulled me aside one day in the house. And he said, I want to talk to you. I said, yeah. Now, he's a musician. He said, it seems to me like you are going to stick with this. This is your profession. I said, yeah, it is. He said, okay, first of all, what you're doing, this is a job. It's your job. I went, okay. He said, and if there's 10 people in the audience or 10,000, every single one of them put their hand in their pocket and took out their money and paid to see you. And you owe them. And I went, oh, the best lesson I could have ever been given. That gave me my work ethic on stage for the rest of my life.
So I'm hearing this story. And of course, I'm wondering, we're of a certain age and I immediately think of the Partridge Family now. Like, I don't know, were you a consultant on this or did they consult you? I mean, because that sounds like the story.
It's so funny. That's a little bit watered down version of what we did, but
of course, everything is.
It was a musical upbringing. It was. We did family shows, every get together, you know, all the family trips in the car. We sang. It was 2 sisters and 3 sisters, then 4 sisters. My brother played. Just a real musical family. Yeah, it was.
Did your mom? Did she play?
My mom sang, but she wasn't a musician or anything. But her whole family, which she never stopped telling us, were campers in the religion and hungry. So she kept saying, you get your voices from me. Well, according to her, I get my voice from her, my sensitivity, my heart, and my morals.
All the good qualities, right? All the bad qualities are from dad.
All my bad qualities.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was my dad's dream for his kids to make it because he worked at General Motors in the day and then worked in the evening as a musician. So he was all for it, like I said, nothing but encouragement, nothing but encouragement.
All right, so then let's go to London. All of a sudden they're like, Susie, we want you and just you, and we're going to groom you in London, which is not Detroit.
No.
And yeah, so I mean, you know, that was touched on a lot in the documentary, but you were literally by yourself. You didn't have anybody else. You didn't have, right?
I was. It was probably the loneliest time of my life before I formed the band again. I was in Cradle. They had pushed me to the back. I got really good on my bass at that point, naturally. Mickey came, saw it, and he picked me out, and he said, I want you. It was all done within 1 week. Elektra Records had been to see the band.
Yeah.
And Jack Waltzman, the president, offered me a solo contract. The same week Mickey flew in, saw the band, offered me a solo contract. Jack Holtzman said, I'll take it to New York and make into the next Janis Joplin.
And he was with Elektra, right? Jack was Elektra.
And Mickey said, I'll take it to London and make into the first Susie Quattro. So guess where I went? I'm not Janis Joplin. He didn't see me, I didn't think. Didn't see me who right. I was. You know, I'm a rocker. Janis was a blueser. I'm a rocker.
You find that a lot in the music business. When something has been successful or well-received, you know, by an audience, they try to mold you into that.
I didn't want to be molded into anything. I didn't find this out till about 2 or 3 years after I came to London, where I got very friendly with Mickey's wife, or his widow now, who I'm still friendly with, very friendly with now. She's a good friend. He called her after seeing me in Detroit. He called her quite late at night because, you know, 5 hours different. Yeah. And he called her and he said, he's really excited. He said, I found it. I found it. I found it. At last, I found it. And she said, what? And he said, I don't know, but I found it. And that kind of explains it all to me, you know?
Yeah.
Because it was unusual. I couldn't have even told you what it was. I didn't know I had something different. I did know the whole time that I was in the bands that I could not find my niche to fit into because I didn't follow any other rules. It's the only way I can explain it. Nothing felt right. Yeah. So I knew that whatever I had was a one-off kind of thing or it hadn't been done before. So I thought, okay, I just got to stick to this. Got to be me. Can't be anybody else.
So that brings up another point because a lot of the other part is finding the songs. And so a lot of the songs were created by a different team. Your producers, Mike Chapman.
Nicky Chen, yeah.
And was that a fighting point? Like, I need to create my own songs or I like these songs that you're bringing to me. Obviously, you like them. Was that like a discussion like, okay, who's going to write these songs and or we want to write these songs based on your personality and your stage persona?
Oh, it happened very easily. It happened nicely. Mickey signed me as a singer, songwriter, musician. That was how he brought me over to England. The plan was to make an album and send me back. So we made quite a few recordings with really good studio people, me on bass. I was going stir crazy. So I told Mickey, I need to form a band and get on the road. This isn't working for me. Nothing was happening. We couldn't find the direction naturally by myself, you know. So I got the band together and the band then rehearsed up all my original songs. Then we went on tour with Slade and Thin Lizzy and the band formed. It really got its sound and its style. And when we came back from that tour, Mickey said, okay, your band is sounding really good. He said, and I like everything you're doing all original material. He said, I've just signed these two single writers, singles. He said, do you mind if they come and see what you're doing? And maybe craft a 3-minute single out of it. And I said, not whatsoever. That'd be dumb to say no. So they came, watched the show. And they wrote Can the Can, number one. We had a real good relationship. I wrote most of the albums with my ex and then eventually by myself. And they would provide most of the time the 3-minute advertisement for the album.
All right. Explain Can the Can. What? I've listened to it so many times.
Can it. You want to put something safe? Can it.
Get rid of the... Well, what's the can? Can the can.
It's just saying good.
Okay.
That's the secret. All these years.
So you release these great singles and they start to hit in the UK. And of course, the UK made sense because you're living there, you're performing a lot in that area.
all over the world, actually. And I started going back in America in 74. That was my first tour. And I worked a lot, 74, right there up until 1981. We did tours every year. There was a little space of that era, 73, 74, where whatever was happening everywhere else in the world wasn't hitting in America. Nobody can explain that. They just didn't get that little couple of years. I don't know why. But I mean, everybody, then they got to know me. They knew me anyway, because I did lots of tours.
Yeah.
And my albums did well. And I made lower end of the charts. But then, of course, Happy Days made me a household name. Yeah.
And you did have Rodney. We're in Los Angeles, so Rodney was, he got you. Did you ever go to the English Disco? I you know, we were too young. What was that like, that scene?
That was great. We did the Whiskey, we did the Roxy, we did all those clubs. The Whiskey, the guy said we had the most people in since the Doors. The line was around blocks and blocks and blocks. So people definitely knew who I was, but we didn't have the single success there.
Yeah.
That was the difference. Yeah.
And why Australia? I mean, you had tremendous success in Australia.
I'm their lady, you know. I'm now about to do my 38th tour there.
Oh, my God.
Oh, and there's me not liking to fly. You must be kidding.
Yeah.
I always say that's God's natural balance.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you a successful career in show business, but I'm also going to give you a fear of flying. Okay.
Deal. Yeah, there's your...
Deal, yeah, it was a deal.
What do you do for the fear of flying?
I just live with it. It's much better. I used to pretend I was fine, and now I don't. And because I just say I'm not, then I am absolutely fine.
Yeah.
Just basically, I fly all the time. Got to do what you got to do. Mickey called me in his office. I had missed a TV show in Germany because I just didn't want to get on the airplane, and he went a little bit mad at me. Called me in his room in his office, and he said, your single's coming out in America, and it's going to be a hit. He said, you can't go everywhere by boat and train and car in America. You're going to have a choice to make. You can have a small career or a big career. Very clever. I started to fly.
No choice.
He put it right.
We are an 80s podcast, and you're releasing these three albums, they're coming out again, Rock Hard.
The Rock Box.
Yeah, Main Attraction and Unreleased Emotion. The 80s, I think it might have been the kind of, for you creatively, kind of an interesting period. I think you might have kind of explored different options in the 80s.
I did. Yeah. I started to write a lot by myself. It was at that point that I remember saying to my ex that he wasn't really writing with me anymore. And he said, I'm not. So I was on my own. And then I did start to explore. I wasn't trying to fit into Susie Quattro anymore. I was just writing. So I felt free.
Do you feel like there's two different, there's like Susan Quattro and Susie Quattro? Are those two different people, or are you always Susie?
I'm always Susie Quattro, but there is little Susie from Detroit and Susie Quattro. My autobiography was written in two people. So little Susie from Detroit and Susie Quattro. There's definitely two of those. And you want to know who you're talking to now, right?
Yeah, right, yeah. Well, you got the turtleneck sweater. You're not wearing a cat suit. I think I know which suit. This is little Susie.
Is Susan?
Yeah.
Oh.
Talking to little Susie.
So you do a radio show. We both come from radio. So I'm curious. You've been doing a radio show for years on BBC.
15 years on BBC Radio 2. I was always told when I started to do interviews that I have a really good radio voice, apparently. It's very, very personal. Sounds like I'm talking just to you. And eventually they approached me. And yeah, 15 years, I finally stopped. But I do like radio. I do like being on the other side of the microphone. I find that interesting. I did my own series of shows. I did documentaries. I did Quattrophonic. I was even up for the Sony Broadcaster of the Year Award. It was quite a natural thing for me to talk on the radio. I did everything. I had my own themed show called Quattrophonic. I did 2 years of documentaries. I had Rockin' with Susie Q. Then I had Wake Up Little Susie. Lots of documentaries that I've got to meet a lot of people that way. Yeah. I enjoyed the process. I enjoyed it.
It's howling. That gave you that kind of a raspy voice. That's a good radio voice when you can...
It is a good radio voice.
Yeah.
I was told that right from the start. They used to say, oh, you should do radio. I said, I'm having a hit record. What's the matter with you?
It's a fallback career.
Yeah.
Okay. And so actually talking about America, I was, because it's on Wikipedia, I assume it's true, but it said in April 2013, you performed for the first time in 30 years since 1983 at the Detroit Music Awards. 30 years you didn't play in America. Why can't we see you, Susie?
I don't know. It drives me crazy. It's like every time I try to get something happening over there, it falls through at the last minute. I did play Canada in 2019, did two shows at the casino there, sold it out, 5,000 people. I think there's going to be a big splurge now to get me to do shows there. I have people working on it. I will be back.
Okay. I like to hear that.
I promise.
And yeah, we got to push you for the Rock Hall. Is that, does that interest you at all? The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Is that like something?
I'm in great company not being in it, but
yeah, it's true.
Whenever I talk to people about it, and everybody says this, it's just so, the only word I can find is stupid.
Yeah.
It's just dumb. It's like a no brainer. You put the first one in there. The first one.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.
So I hope they correct it. I have a feeling they will eventually correct it.
And what is that Susie Quatro show now? Like at the Royal Albert Hall, a little mixture of everything.
We know the intro.
Yeah, we know the intro.
For about 5 years now, I've been doing my solo 2 hour show with an interval. And I take you right the way through the hits, favorite album tracks, do some talking, show some pictures. It's like a real evening of entertainment taking you through my entire career. And it's just, it's my favorite kind of show to do. No time limit. Just get in there with the people, you know, becomes one big living room.
So, yeah, I would imagine like you're, you know, when you worked, did like Annie Get Your Gun, you started to learn like, oh, did that help your concert shows, you know, realizing like what musicals are like and how they present their story?
Yes, it did. It made you focus more. You have to draw everything in. It's a different thing to rock and roll where you let it out. This is more here. And it taught me a vocal warm-up that I use for every single rock and roll show. 15-minute, very hard calisthenics vocal warm-up. I wouldn't do a show without it now. So that's what that gave me. I always knew I could act. I always knew I could do musicals. I am unashamedly an artiste, and I do have many feathers in my cap. It's just how I am. I'm creative.
Yes, and you have a book of poetry.
I'm just about to release my second book of poetry. I'm now on my 6th book. Jeez, unbelievable. So I've just now put it all together. It's just gone to the publishers. And yeah, I love poetry. I love writing. I love creating. My 3 keywords, create, communicate, entertain. That's me. The poetry comes anywhere. And I've been writing so much these last 2 years. Unbelievable.
That's great.
Can't seem to stop.
Yeah, I'm glad you included that in the documentary. That was really, really cool. Amazing.
Nice touch. Yeah.
And also, again, from Wikipedia, there was I don't know, there was another attempt at a documentary originally that to do a Susie Quatro documentary.
My friend Vicky Blue, one of the people involved in that documentary, decided she didn't like the way she looked on camera and wouldn't give permission for her bits to be shown. And it kind of took a lot out of it. So that was what, I don't want to name any names, but you know, they happily gave the interview and didn't like how they looked afterwards. So, but you know, she might release that one day. I don't know. We're good friends.
Okay. Yeah. And they,
how interesting.
And you couldn't borrow any of that to put in this current doc. This,
no.
Yeah.
She wants to keep that pure, and I don't blame her, you know.
Oh, this was great. This Susie Q was a great, and it had your, obviously your full.
Really good. I wanted it, warts and all. That's what I insisted on. I said, unless it tells the whole story, even with the cringe moments in it, which are the best. Cringe moments, you know, where you want to crawl out of the theater. They're the best moments. So, yeah, everybody loved it for the reason that it was a real documentary.
Indeed. Okay, Susie. Well, thank you so much for your time. This was wonderful.
And thank you so much.
Yeah.
My pleasure.
We look forward to get to the States. Would you? Come on. We're waiting for you.
I know. I'm trying. And believe me, I will get there. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, that was great. Susie Quatro, ladies and gentlemen. How about that?
Oh, future Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. Should be current Rock and Roll Hall of Famer for sure. She's an icon. I wish we had more time with her.
Yes, well, you know, rockers gotta rock, so. I was waiting for you to ask your Leather Tuscadero questions or something.
Oh, God, I wish we would. I did want to ask more about Leather Tuscadero, but I didn't want to, you know, that to be the focus. I could obsess over that for a while.
Pinky's younger sister.
Roz Kelly.
Oh, look at you. Yeah, big
that
fan.
Was Pinky. Come on, I know my happy days.
Nice.
Yeah, no, she was, but even because I didn't know much about her, I don't think any of us did when she was on Happy Days. When she showed up, you just thought she was the coolest, you know, just for the way she presented herself.
Right.
You know, and the role she played.
And standing next to Richie Cunningham, who was the nerdiest of the nerds, and, you know, like, oh my God, okay, there's the difference.
Yes.
You're Richie Cunningham and she's Leather. Tuscadero. Susie Quatro, the coolest of the cool.
Yeah. Yes. And she is. So Stumbling In was her biggest, you know, her only huge hit here. Well, I think it was huge. Was it as huge as I remember it?
Number three.
Yeah.
I forgot to ask about Stumbling. I wanted to bring that one up, but.
Yeah. Our love is a lie. And so we begin. Foolishly laying our hearts on the table. Stumbling in.
never really broke through in the States. And that's probably why she's not in the Rock Hall right now.
Yeah.
Like people think just stumbling in and Leather Tuscadero and that's it.
Yeah, but I mean, they have to be looking. And if it's the musicians, that we understand it a little better now, the musicians that are putting forth the artist, I mean, everybody knows her and who she is and what her contribution is.
Yeah.
Whether or not her hits were huge here, her contribution to music, it just seems weird. I mean, so almost random that she wasn't, that she was so huge there. And I mean, maybe like glam, her thing. Like the more I listen to her music, because I listened to a lot over the last few days, it is pretty glammy, actually. She is just, I love everything about her. She seems very genuine. Like she says about herself, she just, you know, what you see is what you get.
Yeah, that was key to her success, I think. Yeah. She was just being herself.
So I'm going to challenge our listeners to give a listen to, but some of her other albums, I challenge you to have a listen because it's rocking.
Don't challenge. What we learned from Susie Quattro is you don't tell people what to do. They'll do the opposite.
That's true. Okay.
So keep Susie out of the Rock Hall, please. I mean, she does, you know, clearly she, you guys are doing the right thing by keeping her out. She has three album box set, three disc sets, Rock Hard, Main Attraction, Unreleased Emotion. I looked on All Music and they had this quote about the album Rock Hard saying, "Rock Hard is a necessity and a solid listen for anyone interested in what female-oriented rock was like before the advent of girl rockers like L7 and Hole."
Yeah, very, very good.
Let's wrap up this episode. Once again, we have new episodes every Friday and some of this will be chopped up. You want to see what Susie looks like? Susie looks great.
She's amazing.
Right. Holly chops up these episodes and you can give a look. Her wall of gold records is pretty impressive.
It's real. It's not a backdrop. Those are all her gold records and there were more than just what you see. But yes, it will be on YouTube at What Difference Does It Make Podcast and our other social media at WDDIM Podcast.
We are a proud member of the Pantheon Podcast family. Love it. Okay, so until next Friday, make sure to subscribe so you know, you get that reminder that we are here every Friday on the What Difference Does It Make Podcast. This is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.